Bienvenue dans le salon de lecture Jacques Kerchache. Nous avons l'honneur donc d'accueillir aujourd'hui le professeur Joseph Tainter et Dominique Michelet. Nous les accueillons dans le cadre de ce trimestre qui a été organisé, qui s'appelle Les œuvres du désastre, qui a été initialement programmé dans le cadre de l'exposition Maya. Et donc aujourd'hui, les deux chercheurs sont réunis pour parler de ce du sujet « Comment les sociétés décident-elles de leur survie ?» Le professeur Joseph Tainter est donc anthropologue, historien, professeur à Utah State University. Dominique Michelet est aussi chercheur, directeur de recherche au CNRS. Je vais leur laisser la parole. Je vous remercie d'être ici dans une si belle journée, pour une si belle journée. Vous êtes venus nombreux pour écouter. Donc chacun de nos intervenants va vous faire une présentation avec illustrée d'images. Et puis, à l'issue de ces deux présentations, vous pourrez poser des questions si vous le désirez. Voilà. Le professeur Joseph Tainter parlera bien sûr dans sa langue et Madame Arbonneau, que nous remercions d'être ici également, fera la traduction. Je vous remercie pour votre patience et voilà, je donne la parole donc à Dominique Michelet qui va commencer.
So I hope to make several points today. Firstly, sustainability and collapse are actually different outcomes of the same historical processes. Secondly, societies grow complex and costly to solve problems, and this can lead either to sustainability or to collapse. And thirdly, the factors that lead to sustainability or to collapse develop over long periods, and these periods are generations to centuries. And so I say that sustainability must be a historical science. Collapse is a term that has many colloquial meanings, and so I think we must start by defining what we mean by it. There has been great interest in collapse recently, including some special editions of this popular science literature, including Cahiers des Sciences et Vie. Collapse is the rapid simplification of a society. Societies collapse, as I say, from the same processes by which they become more complex. And so first, we must understand complexity. And I will talk a little bit about what I mean by complexity. So my perspective on complex societies comes from my background in anthropology, where one of the oldest questions has always been, how did human societies go from this to this? The difference, therefore, is societies that have little differentiation in their structure, very few distinctions other than those based in biology, age, and sex, to societies that are large, differentiated, and highly integrated with much organization. For example, the societies of hunter-gatherers generally have only a few dozen kinds of social personalities, while modern censuses, in contrast, recognize 10,000 to 20,000 distinct occupations. We look at it this way. There are two elements to cultural complexity. There is diversification and specialization in structure and in function and behavior. And secondly, there is increasing integration and control of behavior. So cultural complexity then consists of structure and organization. And we can separate these analytically But of course, in practice, they are opposite sides of the same thing. One cannot exist without the other. A system must have high structural differentiation and high organization to be considered what anthropologists call a complex society. If the system lacks one or the other, if it lacks structure or if it lacks organization, then it is not complex. To illustrate, a number of years ago, the late anthropologist Julian Steward was trying to illustrate what he meant by complexity. And he mentioned that when U.S. forces last landed in Casablanca in 1942, they brought with them 500,000 types of military artifacts. This is great structural diversity, which he considered to be an index of complexity. But the problem, as I discovered in reading a few years later, is that this was not actually a complex system because it lacked organization. Material, when it was loaded onto the ships in docks on the U.S. East Coast, was loaded haphazardly rather than in the proper way, which would be to put things in the reverse order from which you would need them on landing. And so items were stowed everywhere and anywhere on a ship. Soldiers broke windshields climbing over vehicles to find things. And at the landing, the chaos was predictable. Nothing landed in the order in which it was needed. As the journalist Rick Atkinson has observed, and I quote, guns arrived on the beach with no gunners, with no gun sights, guns arrived with no ammunition, guns arrived with no gunners. To find any one thing, it was necessary to unload everything. So contrary to what Julian Steward thought, this was not a complex system. It was structurally differentiated, but it lacked organization. But conversely, in this picture from the Beijing Olympics, there is very high organization, but no structural diversity. Colloquially, we think of complex systems as complicated, but there is irony in complexity because, in fact, complexity simplifies. And I want to emphasize this point. I will repeat it again. Complexity simplifies. The elaboration of structure and organization simplifies and channels behavior. As another example, before the financial crisis of 2008, there was structural differentiation in the financial products industry. There were many new kinds of financial products, derivatives, and so forth. But in the United States, by not calling these products insurance, the industry escaped regulation. The system lacked organization in the form of regulation. So the financial collapse of 2008 was, at least in part, the result of a lack of complexity. So a collapse occurs when a society rapidly loses an established level of complexity. Post-collapse societies are simpler, they have fewer parts, they are less well organized, and they are often smaller. Okay, very briefly, some examples of societies that have collapsed. It is actually a fairly common phenomenon. The Western Roman Empire in the 5th century AD, of course, and as we have just heard, the collapse of the classic lowland Maya of Guatemala. The Hittite Empire of Anatolia at the end of the 13th century BC. Minoan civilization of Crete, 14th century BC. Mycenaean civilization of Greece. And there are actually many more, but perhaps we should skip over these. Okay. One of the common misconceptions about cultural complexity is that complexity is voluntary, that it develops simply because people invent things. This belief is deeply embedded in the cosmology of Western industrial societies. We describe it by the term progress. There is a problem with this belief. The problem is that complexity costs. In any living system, as you differentiate structure and increase organization, there is a metabolic cost. Now, in animal organisms, this is very simple to calculate. We calculate it in terms of calories. In humans, the cost is paid ultimately in the currency also of energy, but indirectly through surrogate accounting systems with which we are more familiar, such as time, money, taxes, and annoyance. In terms of understanding why human societies become more complex, It's important to remember that in the past, increasing the complexity of a society meant that people worked harder. We are largely unaware of this today because to us complexity appears to be free. We pay for it through fossil fuels. In the past, though, the cost of complexity must always have acted to constrain increases in complexity. But this leaves us with a difficult question. If complexity costs, why in human history over the last 5,000 years has complexity seemed always to increase? The reason is that complexity is a primary way that we solve problems. When we are confronted with problems, our solutions tend to involve such things as more elaborate technologies, a proliferation of specializations and social roles, the processing of more information, and engaging in new kinds of activities. For example, to deal with the problem of terrorism, we have differentiated structure. There are new government bureaus, at least in the United States, and we have increased organization. That is, control over the types of behavior from which we think a threat might arise. And as we know, this has imposed monetary and other kinds of costs on all of us. As a second example, to deal with problems of oil consumption and pollution, manufacturers now sell automobiles with two engines where previously one was sufficient. The structure has been differentiated. There are now two different kinds of engines. The organization comes through software that makes the two engines work together. So, to summarize to this point, the important points are, firstly, complexity grows incrementally as problems are addressed. Secondly, complexity has benefits and costs, and higher complexity carries higher costs. Thirdly, changing complexity changes the benefit-cost ratio of complexity. Finally, over time, changes in the benefit-cost ratio of complexity can make a society vulnerable to economic stagnation and or to collapse. Complexity can produce diminishing returns. So how does this come about? A prolonged period of diminishing returns to complexity in problem solving makes a society increasingly vulnerable to collapse. Firstly, because fiscal weakness makes the society vulnerable to problems that it can no longer afford to solve. Secondly, the population, the people, become disaffected as complexity and costs increase, think of taxes increasing, but problem solving becomes ineffective. So, enough of theory. Now we will talk about how do we apply this, and I will talk about the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, because we have just had a very fine talk on the Maya, so we don't need to talk about the Maya more. But also the collapse of the Roman Empire conveys very important lessons about sustainability that I will come to at the end. Initially, Rome's conquests were highly profitable. For example, in 167 BC, the Romans captured the Macedonian treasury and were able to eliminate taxation of themselves. When Pergamon was annexed in 130 BC, the state budget was doubled. When the Roman general Pompey conquered Syria, the state budget was raised another 70%. And when Julius Caesar conquered Gaul, he obtained so much gold that the value of gold in Rome fell by 36%. So the mechanism was that when the Romans conquered a province, they would seize much of the accumulated surpluses of past solar energy. This was the wealth of these provinces. It was the accumulated surpluses of past solar energy that was transformed into precious metals, works of art, and people. So this was what systems theorists call a positive feedback system. More conquests gave more wealth, which funded more conquests. But empires cannot go on forever. Conquest phases usually don't last very long. Eventually, empires run out of profitable conquests. And at this point, an agrarian empire has to shift from living off the appropriated wealth of conquered peoples to living off annual solar energy. So for a one-time influx of wealth from each conquered province, Rome had to undertake administrative and military responsibilities that lasted centuries. Now, our popular image of the Roman Empire is that it was enormously wealthy, but in fact it had an economy based on solar energy and subsistence agriculture, and it was much like a third world economy of today. A few people were fabulously wealthy, but most were desperately poor. Subsistence agriculture paid about 90% of taxes. During the first few two centuries AD, as a result, there were repeated fiscal crises. This was after the major phase of expansion was over, and Augustus, the first emperor, often relieved the state budget from his own wealth, but that had come from the conquest of Egypt. Because of this, the government was always short of funds. The slide here shows the decline of the silver content of the Roman denarius, the main coin, the main silver coin. Beginning in the year 64, the Emperor Nero debased the denarius, decreasing the silver content from 98% to 93% silver. And as you can see, this was the first step down a slope that resulted two centuries later in a currency that was worthless and a government that was insolvent. Now, this is a chart that pertains specifically to the currency of the Roman Empire, but there is also a certain timelessness to this chart. It has lessons, I think, for all times. One of the important lessons is that governments are always insolvent. It is perfectly normal and expectable. We can skip most of this time up until about the 3rd century AD when we will take up the narrative again. The crisis of the empire came in the half century from 235 to 284. Fiscal distress coincided during this period with a 50-year span that nearly brought the empire to an end. There were repeated foreign invasions and civil wars. Emperors were continually overthrown. The average reign was 30 months, and that included one emperor who ruled for 15 years. And at one time, the empire broke into three parts, and it looked at this point as if the Roman Empire would soon come to an end. In 238, the government introduced a new coin called the Antoninianus, at least that's what we call it. We don't know what they called it. This is it on the bottom here. It was supposedly worth two of the denier. But it actually weighed only one and one half. And sometimes the government would take in these as taxes and restrike them as these as worth approximately twice as much. So the government made a profit of 200% merely by collecting old coins and issuing new ones. Cities across the empire had to build new walls, and the perimeters of cities shrank. Lyon contracted from 160 to 20 hectares. Paris contracted to the Ile de la Cité. The situation ultimately was rescued by a series of reforming emperors who ruled in the late 3rd and early 4th centuries. Their strategy was to increase the complexity and size of the main problem-solving institutions, the government and the army. For example, in increasing structural differentiation, they subdivided provinces to prevent emperors from rebelling. They expanded the size of government, and the number of capital cities went from one to, at sometimes, four. The empire was increasingly ruled by separate governments in the east and the west. They also doubled the size of the army and increased the proportion of cavalry being particularly expensive. There are also increasing controls on behavior, organizational changes. Workers were frozen into hereditary occupations that the government deemed essential, including the army. The government conscripted workers and guilds for such things as shipping and building new walls around cities. Farmers were tied to the land. Diocletian tried to freeze prices. Most remarkable of all, the government assessed every plot of land across the entire empire, that is, every field, every orchard, every pasture, for tax. This had to be done within a few years, and the recording alone must have been an enormous task. This was all costly, of course, as complexity is, and the government had to raise taxes to pay for it. Taxes were apparently doubled, and then doubled again during the course of the 4th century. The tax on a person or on a plot of land had to be paid regardless of the actual yield. This was a severe burden on a population of subsistence producers. The government always had a backup on taxes. villages were liable for taxes on their members. One village could be held liable for another. Tax obligations extended to widows and orphans and to dowries. The result was that population could not recover from plagues in the second and third centuries. Peasants were unable to support large families. There are reports of peasants selling their children into slavery because they could not feed them. Marginal lands went out of production because of the taxes on them. This slide shows a new coin introduced in 296, which you can see from the chart proceeded to decline in value. The currency debasements were, of course, inflationary. This slide shows the price of wheat in Egypt at various times in the 4th century. People would make payments carrying sacks of coins, which sounds like 1920s Germany. These reforms were very costly. The late empire taxed its citizens heavily, conscripted labor, and regulated occupations. Peasants could not pay taxes. They abandoned their lands to work for wealthy landowners. Lands were abandoned and population declined. The Roman Empire survived the 3rd century crisis, but what it did was it went from living off interest, that is, yearly agricultural production, to consuming its capital resources, which were producing lands and peasant population. And this made the collapse inevitable from the cost of the effort to solve problems. And I want to emphasize the point that they went from living off interest to living off capital. We come now to the implications of this study and of the theory of collapse for what sustainability means. And this gives us some insight, I think, into our situation today and in the future of our own societies. In colloquial discourse, it is assumed that sustainability emerges as a passive consequence of consuming less, that sustainability emerges as a function of conservation or as a function of improvements in technical efficiency so that we use less resources per unit of consumption. One of the lessons of this study is that sustainability is an active condition of problem solving. It is not a passive consequence of consuming less. Complexity is a problem-solving tool, including problems of sustainability. Complexity is an economic function with benefits and costs and can reach diminishing returns. Now, here is where the lessons begin to become disturbing. We see in the case of the Roman Empire that sustainability may require greater consumption of resources, not less. Complexity in problem solving causes damage subtly, unpredictably, and cumulatively. A more complex solution to problems always seems at the time to be reasonable and affordable. It is the cumulative costs that do the damage. And finally, and I think the most disturbing lesson of all, is that a society or other institution can be destroyed by the cost of sustaining itself. Okay, I will conclude with a quotation from an American journalist, Eric Severide, who was the author of many, many bon mots, many famous sayings, of which I particularly, of which I particularly like this one: the chief cause of problems is solutions. The solutions that we implement at one point in time inevitably set in motion new problems that we will have to confront in the future. There is no such thing as sustainability forever. Bien, merci, and merci to traducteur.
Est-ce que certains d'entre vous souhaiteraient poser une question, soit à Dominique Michelet, soit à Joseph Tainter? Oui? Je vais vous demander de parler dans le micro. Merci.
Oui, bonjour messieurs. Alors, c'est une question finalement à vous deux. Il y a d'autres savants qui se sont intéressés à la fois aux complexités, à l'effondrement, au déclin, il faut préciser bien sûr le vocabulaire des sociétés passées ou actuelles, Et je pense, bien sûr, vous l'avez dit, Monsieur Michelet, à Jared Diamond. Alors, est-ce que vous pensez, est-ce qu'on peut dire que Monsieur Tainter a plus une vision, politique et institutionnelle de l'effondrement, alors que peut-être Diamond aurait une vision plus naturaliste ou écologique, c'est-à-dire que les facteurs de déclin seraient plus des pénuries de ressources, alors que chez Tainter, ce serait plus des complexités sociales, quoi. Par exemple, la différenciation des rôles.
Yes, of course. Jared Diamond focuses primarily on the resources on which a society depends, and he is a gentleman who is very concerned about our future and about anthropogenic degradation of the environment. One of the dissatisfactions that I have with his work is that his conception of collapse is not very rigorous. For example, genocide in Rwanda he considers a collapse, but genocide against Jews in World War II or genocide against Armenians, these do not show up in his case studies. And I think this comes from his background in biology, where a rapid reduction in population is considered a collapse. My focus does tend to be more on the interaction between what happens within a society and what happens outside the society. I am very interested in the internal dynamics of how complexity evolves in a society, but at the same time, complexity involves resources and depends on resources, depends ultimately on energy, so that energy, although it is perhaps the focus of Jared Diamond's work, in my own work, one difference is that I look at how energy interacts with the dynamics within societies, and I think that it is this interaction between within and without that truly gives us a picture of collapse.
C'est pas très facile de répondre à votre question, mais j'aurais tendance à dire que, pour avoir lu les deux auteurs, Joe Tainter ici et donc Diamond aussi, je trouve la démarche de Tainter beaucoup plus systémique en réalité que celle de Diamond. Je ne voudrais pas être très méchant, mais Diamond est quelqu'un de très intelligent, certains de ses chapitres sont très bons, mais il écrit des chapitres qui sont très faibles à côté. Il a une perspective beaucoup plus, si vous voulez, presque journalistique. C'est pourtant un universitaire. C'est quelqu'un qui... Il se comporte parfois comme s'il n'était pas professionnel. Or, c'est un universitaire. Donc, personnellement, il y a des chapitres qui me plaisent bien dans son ouvrage. Il y en a d'autres que je trouve d'une faiblesse insigne. Il y a des choses qui manquent. Il passe à côté de certaines questions. Et la démarche de Joe Tainter, qui a évolué depuis les années 80, bien sûr, me paraît beaucoup plus intéressante parce que plus systémique.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for your conference. Je vous remercie mille fois pour cette conférence qui, je pense, est absolument au centre, pas seulement des anthropologues, pas seulement des économistes, pas seulement des politiciens, mais de tous les mondes. Je pense les scénarios que vous avez peints, professeur Tainter, your scenario is grim. Et les raisons principales est que qu'est-ce que c'est la société actuelle? Je pense que nous vivons dans une société mondiale. I think if we live in a society which is global, we also have new factors from looking retrospectively at the past, which is acceleration by technology, and there's no way out. The world is round, we are going in circles, in milliseconds you transfer capital. The very famous economist Vogel, Josef Vogel in Berlin, is saying that what statesmen do today, and he commented very recently on the euro crisis, is people invest in the future. This is not what people in the past did. So my question is, are we actually operating today with the same vocabulary which you have put to us, the vocabulary of science looking at the past as a historian? And I think this kind of Babylonian confusion that each science, that each discipline is using the terminology in its own sense, makes it so difficult to come around the table in an interdisciplinary fashion. So the question in front of all of us is actually, is this devaluation and inflation at the same time, which you so remarkably well demonstrated with the Roman dinar, is that the same thing that's happening with these fictive investment in futures going on today, except that we don't put less silver in, but we don't know what's going to happen and what decisions are being made in the future. Finally, a point, and I'd like to quote here one dear friend of mine who works also in risk reduction strategies in the UN. This is Maurice King, who talks about a global entrapment, and he has done remarkable work on the, for example, Rwandan genocide, and I don't want to go into this, but his question is, where are we with demographics, the 7 billion we are having, and the non-distribution of resources throughout? On the other hand, we must say modernization, we are really in a global world. I would be happy if you could comment on these questions. And je voulais aussi remercier mille fois Professeur Michelet. Merci.
Thank you for your very good questions. I will try to answer as best I can. Lately, I have been thinking about what I call a society's reserve problem-solving capacity. This is the resources that a society can draw upon in short notice to address an urgent crisis. For the Romans, the reserve problem-solving capacity was embedded in the silver content of the currency, that they were able to get by for a time by reducing the silver content of the currency, although that had long-term consequences, long-term repercussions. The emperors were good politicians, but they were naive economists. Last summer, I was looking at, I was wondering about the production of oil in the Second World War. In the Second World War, the United States produced oil not only for our own military, but also for our allies. Most of the oil used by our allies came from the United States, and today we no longer have the capacity to do that. In World War II, we had reserve problem-solving capacity in the form of oil. If we look at the recent fiscal crisis, we had reserve problem-solving capacity in the ability to borrow, to take on more debt. The industrial societies took on more debt to try to deal with the recession. But we can see from the political backlash and from the programs of austerity that are being imposed everywhere that we are losing. We have mostly used that reserve problem-solving capacity. So we are losing our ability to confront catastrophic problems because we have used up our reserve problem-solving capacity. There is a colleague of mine, George Mobus, at the University of Washington, who argues that debt is feasible only in situations where there are high net returns to energy production. In other words, what is called energy return on investment. It takes energy to get energy. In the 1930s, the United States was able to produce oil at a net of 100 to 1. For every barrel of oil that we would expend in searching for and producing oil, we would get 100 barrels back. For the United States now, that is down to 15 to 1. Worldwide, it is about 18 to 1. In the Persian Gulf, it is about 25 to 1. So you can see the trend. You can see the direction that we are going. My colleague, Dr. Mobus, argues that debt is feasible only when an economy grows because of an abundance of inexpensive energy. As the energy return on investment declines, debt becomes less feasible because there cannot be the economic growth that we have known in the past. So I don't know if I have answered all of your questions, but I have tried to talk to the topics.
Oui, une question pour le professeur Tainter. J'ai remarqué que le mot clé, le concept clé de votre exposé, c'est le mot sustainability, soutenabilité. Et savez-vous que le concept de soutenabilité est un mot d'origine française, mais qui est oublié par les Français? Il s'agit d'un mot dont la première occurrence, le premier usage, c'est dans l'édit de Brunois en 1346 avec Philippe VI de Valois. Il s'agissait pour Philippe VI de Valois de demander à ses fonctionnaires de bien gérer de façon écologique la forêt de Brunois. Il demandait à ses fonctionnaires de la gérer, cette forêt, de façon à ce que la ressource soit perpétuellement disponible à la descendance. Et donc il disait en vieux français « sous » tenable. Et sous-tenable, ça veut dire tenir par en dessous, c'est-à-dire être dessous une charge, exactement sous le centre de gravité, pour avoir cette charge en équilibre. Donc c'est fondamentalement une notion d'équilibre. Et ce très beau concept français sous-tenable est devenu en anglais sustainable. Et hélas, les Français ont oublié cette notion d'équilibre et ils ont tendance, dans la plupart des institutions, à traduire par durable ou durabilité. Et ça, c'est, une, à mon avis, une très mauvaise façon de traduire soutenable. On devrait dire soutenable, puisque c'est une notion d'équilibre. Je répète, être sous le centre de gravité. Il y a la même chose pour le français supporter, supportable. Donc porter par en dessous, également une notion d'équilibre. Étiez-vous au courant de ce problème d'origine du mot sustainable et du problème qu'ont les Français pour traduire ce concept?
I thank you very much. The Oxford English Dictionary gives the etymology of words that come into English from French and other languages, but I did not know all of this detail. And merci. I appreciate knowing all of it. It is very interesting. I think that this is consistent with how I use sustainability, to uphold something. I see sustainability as the science of continuity, with how do you maintain that which we value. Sustainability is a function of human values. You must define what it is that you value, that you want to sustain. Thank you very much.
Est-ce que ce qu'a écrit Jared Diamond sur les Mayas vous semble opérationnel? Vous soutenez-vous la thèse de Jared Diamond sur les Mayas, puisque vous dites qu'il y a des choses qui sont bien et d'autres pas bien?
Je vais reprendre mes notes justement sur le, puisque j'ai annoté toutes ces pages sur les Mayas. Non, si vous voulez, ce qui me gêne dans la démarche de Diamond, c'est encore une fois, et c'est pas seulement vrai sur les Mayas, c'est que effectivement, il épingle une série de difficultés de la société. Et il a lu, on lui a donné à lire, ou des équipes ont lu pour lui un certain nombre de livres essentiels où on insiste sur le problème de la relation entre population-ressources, où on insiste sur le problème de, et ça, il y a des faits historiques pour ça, de dégradation écologique, où on insiste sur la possibilité donc d'avoir des accidents climatiques, bien entendu les rivalités guerrières, et ça, relisez ces dernières pages, vous verrez, il en fait un simple catalogue. Ça n'est pas en d'aucune façon, c'est une explication. Et quand on lit l'ensemble de l'ouvrage, pas simplement sur les Mayas, d'ailleurs, je l'accuse pas de pas avoir d'explication, personne n'en a. Enfin, je veux dire, le modèle, il est encore à construire, il n'est pas construit, si jamais on peut le construire un jour. Mais l'absence de problématique d'une vision systémique des choses, la modélisation, c'est quelque chose qui il passe à côté. Bon, ça c'est une chose. Et deuxièmement, il y a quand même dans le fond de l'œuvre de Diamond une idée qui revient sur plusieurs chapitres, c'est de mettre en cause systématiquement dans tous les cas qu'il étudie les erreurs de jugement et de décision des leaders. Hein, pour lui, c'est quand même le leitmotiv. Si les sociétés passées se sont cassées la figure, c'est que les gens qui les dirigeaient n'ont pas su voir ou n'ont pas pris les bonnes décisions. Et ça, je me demande jusqu'à un certain point si ce n'est pas une vision idéologique des choses. Ça fait vendre, peut-être, je ne sais pas. Mais en tout cas, il y a une idéologie très forte. Les dirigeants n'ont pas été capables et ils n'ont pas vu ou ils n'ont pas pris les bonnes décisions. Donc là, je ne peux pas dire quoi que ce soit du côté des Mayas. Enfin, je veux dire, la psychologie rétrospective des gens qui nous ont abandonnés il y a 12 siècles, moi, je n'y rentre pas. Et on n'a pas effectivement de traces tellement de décisions qui aient été prises pour... Je vais rajouter un dernier détail, si vous me le permettez. On travaille depuis l'an dernier sur un nouveau site au Guatemala. J'ai eu l'occasion d'en parler dans une autre conférence ici dans ce musée quand on a fait notre rencontre le 1er juillet. C'est un cas de figure qu'on n'a pas dans beaucoup de sites. C'est un site qui se prolonge tard avec une réduction de population importante et les dirigeants qui sont là jusqu'au bout ont des moyens économiques importants. Ils sont au cœur de réseaux d'échanges sur plusieurs centaines et milliers de kilomètres. Donc, économiquement, ça a l'air de fonctionner. Et ils se lancent dans des grands travaux, avec une base démographique assez faible, qu'ils ne terminent pas. Mais se lancer dans des grands travaux, qui sont des travaux de construction d'édifices religieux comme ça, alors que le monde s'écroule autour de vous, qu'est-ce que ça veut dire ? Ils n'ont rien compris ou bien ils avaient totalement espoir dans la façon dont eux allaient surmonter les difficultés ? Je n'en sais rien.
Est-ce qu'il n'y a pas sur ce point une explication religieuse, un peu comme les habitants de l'île de Pâques, justement, quelle était la psychologie, disons, de celui qui a coupé le dernier arbre de l'île de Pâques ? Bah, il se référait à Dieu en faisant des offrandes à Dieu, en construisant des monuments, on allait être sauvé.
Oui, c'est possible. Elle reste de l'ordre du possible seulement, peut-être du probable, si on a un peu de chance. Mais ils investissent ailleurs aussi. Je veux dire, ils construisent... Ce qu'on voit le plus, c'est l'interruption du gros monument. Mais dans leur propre résidence, ils investissent à tour de bras. En quelques générations, ils changent 4 fois l'allure de leur résidence. Ils l'enrichissent. C'est leur maison personnelle. Là, pour parler du groupe dirigeant. Oui, mais c'est une tendance de l'anthropologie générale, mais peut-être plus nord-américaine aujourd'hui. Mais enfin, donc, côté européen aussi, on a parlé pendant 30 ans sans aucun complexe et sans doute à tort dans beaucoup de cas de collapse. Aujourd'hui, vous voulez obtenir des financements sur un programme, parler de crise et résilience, ça va fonctionner. Voilà. Parce qu'il faut effectivement imaginer que... Non, c'est une décision pragmatique, politique, actuelle, c'est tout, si vous voulez. C'est pour ça que je disais que c'était politiquement pas quoi. Non, mais c'est un peu ça. D'un autre côté, on a dit beaucoup de bêtises. Je suis désolé, mais le titre de l'exposition, effectivement, qui se termine en quelques heures maintenant, de l'aube au crépuscule, c'est un mensonge. Parce qu'il y a certes, un passage à vide de la civilisation maya, mais il y a eu, après le Xe siècle, un renouveau, et il peut y en avoir un demain. Les Mayas n'ont pas disparu, voilà. Donc, on a tort, effectivement, dans certains cas, d'utiliser des termes définitifs, là où d'autres... Le problème de terminologie dans l'explication des phénomènes sociétaux, c'est quelque chose de terrible. C'est-à-dire, on fait des guerres de religion sur des mots, donc attention. Disons, j'utilise le mot collapse dans tel sens, j'utilise le mot crise dans tel sens, j'utilise le mot déclin dans tel sens, et à ce moment-là, peut-être, les gens ne vont pas vous sauter à la gorge. Il y a beaucoup de choses qui se passent dans le monde maya depuis maintenant un certain nombre d'années, mais notamment ce qui n'existait certainement jamais à l'époque préhispanique, une espèce de prise de conscience de l'unité du monde maya. Les mayas anciens, ce sont au moment où les Espagnols, c'est plus de 30 langues, avec évidemment des contacts entre groupes voisins et de temps en temps, exceptionnellement, des contacts plus lointains. Mais l'idée d'une identité générale maya, c'est quelque chose qui se développe à l'heure actuelle. Et ça, c'est certainement très intéressant à observer. Et dans les exemples que vous citiez, je pense qu'on pourrait quand même citer Rigoberta Menchú. Il n'y a pas beaucoup d'ethnies dans le monde qui ont fourni des prix Nobel de la paix, après tout. Et c'est quelqu'un de remarquable, en plus.
C'est une question pour le professeur Tainter. Je voulais rebondir sur votre dernière phrase et savoir si vous aviez étudié le contre-pied ou le contrepoint de ce que vous définissiez comme un collapse, c'est-à-dire une simplification de la société, d'une société complexe. Alors je pense à ce que disent les Japonais sur les problèmes. Plutôt que de résoudre un problème, il faut le simplifier, il faut le supprimer. Et donc je voulais savoir si justement un moyen de, et si vous aviez étudié ça ou des cas concrets, de rendre une société complexe soutenable en la simplifiant. Voilà, c'est ma question. Est-ce que vous avez étudié ce point-là?
Yes, thank you. That's a very interesting question. I know of only one large complex society that sustained itself by simplifying. And this was the Byzantine Empire after they lost half of their land to the Arabs in the 7th century. And their only choice, they also lost, of course, half of their revenue. Their only choice was to simplify. And what follows is called the Byzantine Dark Age. They greatly simplified the structure of their government. Urbanism disappeared across Anatolia. There were left with only two cities in the empire, Constantinople and Thessalonica. And it is... As I say, to my knowledge, the only example of a large complex society that simplifies, that collapsed, and was able to sustain as much as it could by doing so.
Thanks for the lecture. It was very interesting. I just like to ask you about the Egypt. Can we talk about collapse, about the Egypt people, because they completely disappear, and I'm quite interested in your answer. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. I think you asked me about collapse in Egypt. Yes. Yeah. There is, let me see if I can find it. Okay. There is one major collapse in Egyptian history. It's the collapse of the Egyptian Old Kingdom in 2181 BC. When it is clear that Egyptian unity declined, there are accounts of the royal family having terrible problems. There was apparently also at this time very low Nile floods, and my colleague Fekri Hassan has argued that the government was simply unable to project power up and down the Nile without the Nile floods, that the Nile River as a whole was very low. I don't specialize in Egypt. I don't know a lot more about this case, but it is simply another one of those cases of collapse, one of the many cases of collapse. Thank you.
Je pense que on va peut-être s'arrêter là. Est-ce qu'il y a encore une question très importante ou à laquelle vous tenez beaucoup, que vous aimeriez poser? Non. Merci. Thank you so much, Professor Tainter, Professor Michelet. Merci à vous deux. Merci à vous tous pour ces très intéressantes questions.